unmounted, leaning against the alley walls with his arms unfolded. He raised his eyebrows at me.
"I'm sure you wouldn't betray Lord Delaunay's trust in such a way, would you, Federer?"
"I thought you were on horseback," I said, for lack of a better response. Guy snorted.
"The way the two of you ride? Easy enough to follow on foot. Though you've a knack for it when you forget to think about it," he added to Hyacinth.
To me, he said, "You, Delaunay, should have taught.
And if you've had enough of leading me on a merry chase, I'll take you home to him and tell him so."
There was no gainsaying Guy once his mind was settled. We returned the horses to the stable, and he had the coach brought round. Hyacinth grinned at my annoyance, and it galled me, as it usually did not, to be subject to Delaunay's will. Guy merely gave me a resigned shrug and called to the driver to take us home. Delaunay was not even there, I discovered, when we arrived, and was galled twice over by the knowledge that Guy had dragged me out of Knight's doorstep of his own wishes. The fact that he might have other things to do with his time than spend it shepherding his master's headstrong 1,000 ducat a night en guisette through one of the most unsavory quarters of the city never crossed my mind. For that I can only say that I was young, and filled with all of youth's self-regard. If I had known what was to come, I would have acted differently toward Guy that night, for he had been kind enough in his fashion. But I am ashamed to say that I treated him with sullen disregard. Restless and irritated on my return, I prowled the house as if it were a prison, and came upon Alcuin in the library. I was on the verge of giving vent to my frustration, but something in his face stopped me as he looked up from the letter he was reading. "What is it?" I asked instead. Alcuin folded the letter carefully, smoothing the creases. His white hair gleamed about his face as he bent to the task. "An offer. It came by messenger this evening, from Vital Bouvard." I opened my mouth and closed it. He glanced up sharply at me.
"You know?"
Alcuin had always been better than I at hearing the unsaid. I nodded. "I overheard you the night of Baudouin's natality." I paused. "I'm sorry. I didn't intend to eavesdrop, truly. I've said nothing of it."
"It doesn't matter."
He tapped the folded letter against the desktop, lost in thought. "Why now, I wonder? Does he have somewhat less to fear, now that House Trevelyan has fallen? Or does he fear he's outlived his use to the Stregardza?" I perched on a chair opposite him. "He has seen peers of the realm point fingers at one of the great houses, Alcuin, and lived to gain by it. It has made him bold, and if the profit outweighed his fear, he would do it publicly." I shook my head. "He is sick with desire, and these events have made him rash enough to seek a cure, no more. Have a care with him."
"I will have a care," Alcuin said grimly. "This once, and never again."
"Will you tell that to Delaunay?" I asked hesitantly. Alcuin shook his head.
"Not until it's done. The letter says only that Vital agrees to my request regarding a patron gift. Let Delaunay think it's an assignation like any other. If he knew how I felt, he'd not let me go."
His dark eyes dwelled intently on me.
"Promise me you won't say anything."
It was not much to ask, and he had never asked me for anything before. It was not Alcuin's fault he had been offered his freedom the very night I was chafing at my own bonds. "I promise." Chapter 24. Though it was not my art to do it in the bedchamber, indeed my gift lay in my very inability to do so, I am fairly well skilled at dissembling. In all this time, for example, no patron of mine ever suspected the nature of my education as Delaunay's en guisette, save Melisande Charizai, but she was a separate matter. Even Childeric Desormes, who knew in his bones that Delaunay had a game at stake, never fathomed my part in it until the day I told him.
but if I thought my skills considerable, they were nothing to Alcuin's. I had heard in his voice and seen in his face the depth of his loathing for Vital Bouvard, yet in the days before his final assignation, no trace of it reflected in his demeanour. He was the same as he had always been, gentle-spirited and gracious, calmly accepting whatever fate dealt his way. That which yields, I thought, is not always weak. True to his word, Guy told de Launay that Alcuin and I should be taught to sit a horse properly. De Launay agreed, and Cecily Laveau-Perrin graciously offered the usage of her country estate. It was still maintained by the seneschal appointed by her late husband, the Chevalier Perrin, when he had accepted his post as a counsellor to the king. We spent 4 days at Perrinwald, and when I think back upon it, they were 4 of the happiest days of my life. Something in de Launay eased in the country, a reserve that was so much a part of him I scarce noticed it. The manor was rustic, but clean and well kept. The food was simple but good, and the seneschal's wife, Eloise, prided herself on having a hand in its preparation. The riding lessons themselves were a pain and a delight at once. To Alcuin's and my mutual chagrin, we were placed in the charge of a grinning lad of 11, who sat bareback atop his shaggy pony, as if he'd spent his whole life astride it. But once we put our dignity aside, which incident, I am happy to say, involved a headlong spill, a mitten heap, and Alcuin, rather than me, we found him to be an excellent tutor. By the 3rd day we were neither of us as sore as we had been, and de Launay gauged us proficient enough to be taught a few of the niceties of a nobleman's seat. Our last morning, the seneschal called for a hunt in the early hours, to put a final test to the skill Alcuin and I had gained. The sun rose in the east, long rays slanting over the fertile earth. Green fields, scarce touched with autumn's gold, rushed past as we hurtled over them. Peasants shouted, waving their hats. Far ahead, the hounds belled on the trail of scent. We caught up with the front runners in the orchard. The fox had gone to earth, and the hounds nosed about its den, giving mournful tongue, while the riders milled in the open air. One of the men-at-arms whooped and wheeled his mount. Amid shouting and hallooing, half the hunt dashed back the way it had come, and I saw Alcuin among them, dark eyes shining, his white hair loosed from its braid, lashing his cheek like sea-foam as he turned his horse so sharply it near sat in its haunches. For this, like other things, he had a natural gift. By the time we gained the manor, de Launay's ease had perceptibly lessened. Surely he was no less cordial, but there was a measure of distance in his manner as he laughed and jested, paying the promised sum to the winner. We took our leave after the noon meal was served, and I dare say it was a regretful one on all sides. There are those who hold that there is a pattern to all that is said and done in this world, that nothing happens without reason nor out of time. As to that I cannot speak, for I have seen too many threads cut short to believe it, but of a surety I have seen too the weft of my fate shuttled on the loom. If there is a pattern, I do not think there is any one among us who can stand at a great enough distance to discern it. Yet I will not say that it is not so. I do not know. This, though, I know is true. If Alcuin had not learned to ride in that week's span, events would likely have fallen out differently. And if Hyacinth had not placed his wager as he had, if he had not decided his earnings were blood-cursed, and Guy had not been forced to chase us through the city, who can say? I would not second-guess fate. True to my word, I said nothing of Alcuin's assignation with Vital Bouvard. De Launay had given his approval, and the contract had been signed before ever we left for Perrinwald. When the night arrived, there was some minor confusion over the matter of conveyance. Bouvard sent his coach when de Launay thought to send Alcuin in his own, but the matter was easily settled. De Launay accepted Bouvard's offer of conveyance on the contingency that Guy accompanied Alcuin. This was a matter of course, indeed a part of our contract, so no one thought anything of it. If Bouvard thought twice about it, I do not know. The contract specified merely that Alcuin or I would be accompanied by a liveried servant of the Delaunay household. Because Delaunay was not landed, so we believed, he was not officially entitled to have men-at-arms, and Guy was never sanctioned thusly. He was a quiet man always, and there was nothing about him that marked him as a man of weapons. Many men affect a dagger at the waist. If he wore two, still there was nothing else about him to suggest he had been trained by the Castelline Brotherhood. I had known him for years, and never suspected. The matter of the coach resolved, Delaunay gave Alcuin his blessing. As we never took assignations for the same night, I was there to see him off. He wore the same garb he had worn for his debut, the fawn breeches and the white blouse, Vital's request, I assumed. His expression, calm and tranquil, never faltered, but his hands, when I grasped them, were ice cold. I drew his head down to kiss his cheek. He had grown that much taller than I, and murmured, "Be well." Alcuin's lashes flickered, but he gave no other sign of hearing. Thus he left us for the arms of Vital Bouvard. It was well into the small hours of the morning when he returned. Sound asleep, I thought that I dreamed, and in my dreams Gaspard Trevelyan returned, shouting in the courtyard for Delaunay, loud and terrible. Even after I woke, it took me some moments to place the voice, for I had never heard Alcuin raise his. Then I scrambled out of bed at all speed, throwing on the first garment that came to hand and racing downstairs. Half the household was there already, shocked and bleary-eyed behind raised torches. Delaunay had dressed as hastily as I, and his shirt was half askew, caught up in the sword belt he had lashed round his waist. "What is it?" he was shouting, as I emerged into the courtyard. Alcuin was astride one of the coach-horses, legs clamped to her sides, wrestling with the severed reins. Maddened with fear, she plunged wildly, her traces dangling, nostrils flaring. Alcuin struggled to hold her in check, and his face was grim. "The coach was attacked," he cried, hauling back sharply on the reins. The mare's head came up, foam flying from her mouth where the bit sawed at her lips. Alcuin's white shirt was amber in the torchlight, but I could see a spreading dark stain across the ribs. "By the river. Guy's holding them off, but there are too many. He cut the traces." For a split second, Delaunay stared, then turned to the nearest man, shoving him. "Get my horse." Already there were lights kindling in the stable. Now, wide awake, Delaunay grabbed the carriage horse's bridle, bringing her to a standstill by force of arm and will. Alcuin swung his leg over and dismounted, grimacing as he hit the ground. "Are you..." Delaunay reached out a hand to him. With startling speed, Alcuin struck his hand away, face set with rage. "This wouldn't have happened if you had taught me to use a blade." At that moment a lad emerged from the stables at a run, leading Delaunay's saddle horse. Delaunay turned away, mounting in a flash and grabbing up the reins. "Where?" he asked coldly. Alcuin pressed his hand to his side. "Near the elm grove." Without a reply, Delaunay wheeled his horse and set out, striking sparks against the flagstones. With a sound somewhere between a laugh and a sob, Alcuin sagged to the floor of the courtyard. A bulging purse at his belt struck the stones, gold coins spilling out. I hurried to his side. "My mark, Vedra," he gasped, as I pushed untold wealth out of the way. "Unless I am wrong, Guy will bear the cost of it." "Shh." I held him in my arms and unbuttoned his shirt deftly. If I was good at nothing else, that much at least I could do. I slid my hand inside and felt the wound, covering it with my palm, holding back the pulsing blood. Torches stooped low around us, faces peering to look. I wished we were at Perrinwald, where Eloise would surely know what to do. "Get a physician," I shouted. "Hovel, Beavis, send for the Yeshuite doctor, now!" I do not know how long I held Alcuin against the chill flagstones of the courtyard that night, while footsteps raced around us and voices muttered. It seemed like hours. His blood seeped warm between my fingers, and his face grew pale, while I whispered prayers above him and apologized to Eloa and all his companions for every jealous thought I had ever had. When I saw the dark, solemn face of the Yeshuite doctor bending over Alcuin, it was the most beautiful sight I had ever seen.
"What is he doing on the cold stones?" he asked, clicking his tongue in disapproval. "Do you want him to take a chill and die, if this wound doesn't kill him? You and you, there, carry him into the house."
I relinquished my burden with gratitude, my fingers stuck together with Alcuin's blood. He rolled his eyes in my direction as they lifted him, thanking me without words, and I gathered up the fallen coins and followed them into the house. Alcuin was ensconced on the nearest couch, and the doctor cut his shirt away with expert shears. The wound was long and deep, but not mortal.
"You have lost much blood," the Yeshuite said, matter-of-factly, threading a long needle with silk. "But you will not die of this, I think, because I am here."
He plied his needle without speaking for a time, and Alcuin hissed through his teeth. When it was done, he called for strong spirits and washed the wound, then bandaged it and gave me a container of salve.
"You know how to use this, I think," he said, and the irony was not lost on me, despite his strange accent. "Tell Lord Delaunay to send for me if it mortifies."
Alcuin fumbled at his purse, spilling out coins. I plucked one from the floor and gave it to the doctor. He took it, then glanced at me with raised eyebrows.
"It is a hard life you lead. I hope it is worth the cost."
I had no answer for that, nor did Alcuin, had he strength to speak. The doctor bowed, and one of the servants showed him silently to the door. It opened before he could make his exit, Delaunay entering with a dreadful look on his face and the limp form of Guy in his arms. The doctor paused, laying one hand on Guy's throat and feeling for a pulse. Delaunay looked at him without speaking. The doctor shook his head.
"For him it is too late," he said quietly.
"I know," Delaunay said.
He paused, a shadow crossing his face as he searched for courtesy.
"Thank you."
The doctor shook his head again, sidelock swinging, and murmured something in his own tongue.
"It is nothing," he said,
and though his voice was curt, he touched Delaunay's arm briefly before he left. The door closed behind him. Delaunay laid Guy's body down carefully, arranging his lifeless limbs as if he could still feel discomfort.
"You should have told me," he said to Alcuin. "You should have told me the bargain you made."
"If I had told you," Alcuin whispered, "you wouldn't have let me make it."
He closed his eyes, and the tears that the Yeshuite's needle hadn't bidden seeped from beneath his lids.
"But I never meant anyone else to bear the price."
Delaunay sank down on his knees, bowing his head over Guy's body and pressing his hands against his eyes. I hovered between staying and leaving, wanting to leave him to grieve alone, and not knowing if I should. But his head rose, a terrible imperative in his gaze that outweighed even guilt and grief.
"Who was it?"
he asked, voice scarce more than a whisper.
"Therese and Dominic Strigatza."
Alcuin's eyes opened a crack, speech coming with difficulty.
"Prince Benedict's daughter."
Delaunay covered his eyes again, and a shudder racked him.
"Thank you," he whispered. "Blessed Eloa, I am sorry, but thank you."
Chapter 25. Alcuin was a long time recovering from his wound. It was true that he had lost a great deal of blood, but I dare say it was the blow to his spirit which lay at the heart of the matter. He had known the risk he was taking, but he had never thought past the bedchamber and Bouvard's desperation. Unlike me, Alcuin had never seen Guy act in his capacity as an unofficial man-at-arms. He never reckoned on the coach being attacked, nor Guy's role in the threat, and for that he could not forgive himself. Delaunay, half mad with grief and guilt, would have tended him night and day,
but he was the last person Alcuin wanted to see. I understood it better than I let on. What Alcuin had done for love of Delaunay. He couldn't bear now to reap the reward of Delaunay's concern. So I tended him through his fitful recovery, acting as go-between for them, and gradually got from Delaunay the story of what had happened after he'd left that night. He had arrived in time to find Guy still alive, fighting like a cornered wolf against four attackers. Bouvard's coachman was cowering in the driver's seat, snivelling but unharmed. Delaunay's description of his own arrival was terse. He said only that he dispatched three of the footpads, while the other one fled. But having seen him leave, I can well imagine how he burst onto the scene. When all was said and done, he was a seasoned cavalry soldier and a veteran of the Battle of Three Princes. At first he thought he had arrived in time, but when he turned to Guy, he saw how many wounds he had taken, and the hilt of the dagger that stood out from his ribs. Guy took two steps toward him, then faltered and sank to the street. With a hurled curse at the coachman, Delaunay went to his side. If I describe it as if I were there, it is because Delaunay told me, for he had no one else to tell. And if I have embellished, it is only because I know my lord too well, and know what he left out. Of Guy's heroism he spoke freely. Guy had known. He had felt the coach slow, heard the approach of booted feet racing across the street, and known. He shoved Alcuin out ahead of him, fending off the first attackers as he slashed the traces and got the lead mare free. That was when Alcuin had taken his wound, but Guy had boosted him astride, smacking the mare across the haunches with the broadside of his dagger. All of this he told Delaunay before he died, or most of it at least, for some parts Alcuin filled in later. Of a surety, though, Guy told him they were Bouvard's men, for as he said, "My lord the coachman knew." As Delaunay told it, he knelt by Guy's side all the while, and both of them had their hand on the hilt of the fatal dagger. When Guy had told all he knew, his breath came short, and his skin grew cold and pale. His grip grew limp, fingers falling away from the hilt. I dare say I understood his final words as well as Delaunay, if not better.
"Draw out the dagger, my lord, and let me go. The debt between us is settled."
Delaunay did not tell me that he wept as he obeyed, but I can guess it well enough, for I saw him weep at the telling. Blood enough to kill him, Guy had lost already, but the dagger had pierced a lung. Quick enough it filled. A bloody froth came to his lips, and he died. As for the coachman, I dare say he thought his end was upon him, as Delaunay rose and made toward him, blood-stained sword naked in his hand. But Delaunay did not kill him. It was never his way to slay the weak.
"Tell your master," he said to the coachman, "he will answer to me before the king's justice or on the dueling field, but answer he will."
Delaunay said the coachman gave no reply but to cringe. He gave the man no further heed, gathering Guy in his arms and laying him over his saddle, making his slow way home. For many days the household was in a state of cautious turmoil. Cautious, for all were mindful of both Alcuin's convalescence and Delaunay's mood, yet the turmoil was unavoidable. The servants and I tended Alcuin, while the embalmers came to work their art on Guy, whose body lay in state in his humble room. Delaunay left for a time on the second morning, returning tight-lipped and angry. "Bouvard?" I asked him.
"Gone," came the curt reply. "Packed up and fled to La Serenissima, with half his household."
However extensive Delaunay's web, it was built of information and not influence. If his knowledge extended beyond the bounds of Terre d'Ange, his reach did not. Vital Bouvard was safe enough in the Stray Guards' stronghold. Delaunay paced the library like a tiger, whirling to glare at me.
"No assignations," he ordered, "until Bouvard is brought to justice. I won't risk either of you."
"Either of us," I thought, and stared at him. "You don't know?"
Know what?
Too restless to give his mind over to one matter, he had paused at his desk, tracing the lines of a half-written letter and stabbing his quill at the inkwell. I drew my knees up, wrapping my arms around them. Bouvard's patron gift paid the remainder of Alcuin's mark, I said softly. It was the other half of his price.
Delaunay looked at me, quill suspended in midair.
He what? Why? Why would Alcuin do that?
My lord, I thought, you are an idiot.
For you? Delaunay set the quill down slowly, taking care not to blot the letter. I had seen the address. It was to the prefect of the Castelline Brotherhood.
To ask if Guy could be buried as a member of their order, I assumed.
He shook his head, denying my suggestion.
I would never have asked him to take such a risk. Never. Either of you. Alcuin knew that.
Yes, my lord, I said cautiously. We both of us knew. It is why he did not tell you, and swore me to silence. But the service of Narmer is not in his blood, as it is in mine. He swore himself to it to settle the debt between you.
Guy's words. I saw the blood leave Delaunay's face to hear them.
There was no debt between us, he whispered. My duty to Alcuin lay elsewhere.
In the promise of Prince Roland de la Courcelle?
He was my liege lord.
Delaunay's voice was harsh. I shrank back at it, and he saw, relenting.
Ah, Phaedra, I have trained you too well. Alcuin should have known there is no debt between us.
Then perhaps he is right, and you should have trained him to arms rather than bedchambers and intrigues if you would have honoured the memory of your liege, I said remorselessly.
If my words were cruel, well, I make no apology. That night was too fresh in my mind, the cold stones and Alcuin's blood ebbing between my fingers.
Perhaps,
Delaunay murmured, no protest at my unkindness, gazing past me at some memory beyond my ken.
Perhaps I should.
I loved him too well to make him suffer. Alcuin chose knowing what he did, my lord. Do not belittle what he has done for you. He grieves that Guy paid the price for it. Allow him the dignity of his grief, and he will come around. You will see.
I hope you have the right of it.
His gaze sharpened.
Never more, then. Alcuin's mark is made. And you?
I am pledged to Narmer, my lord, I reminded him gently. You cannot absolve me of that. No more than Alcuin could break his own pledge.
No, Delaunay picked up his quill, but my words stand. No assignations until Bouvard is settled.
He dipped his quill. I had pressed him to the limit of what he would discuss. Reluctantly I cleared my throat.
Yes?
He asked, glancing up. There is the delegate posted to Kebble-e-Marcard, I reminded him. The one who developed exotic tastes in his posting. He is reporting to the king in some 10 days' time, and I am contracted for his pleasure.
The lordling from Lanvers' retinue,
Delaunay tapped the pinion end of the quill against his lower lip, lost in thought.
I had forgotten about him. Desarme must have commended you.
He glanced down at his letter.
Bide, then, and we will see. If it come to it, well, we can claim tragedy in the household, and truly enough, but we shall see.
I bowed my head in silent acknowledgement, having no desire to press him further. Only the weight of his regard forced me to look up again.
Do not do this thing for my sake, Phaedra, he said gently. If it is only for love of me, I beg you, let us beseech the priesthood of Narmer, and find another way to absolve you of your oath. Surely there is a way, for Narmer is compassionate.
I gazed at his beloved face, and the red haze rose in my vision uncompelled, moving from my left eye to obscure the whole of my sight. Behind Delaunay, Kushiel's face floated, stern and uncompromising, and in his hands he bore the rod and flail. In my skin, I shivered. I thought of Alcuin and Guy. No, my lord, I murmured and blinked. My vision cleared. It is you who put a name to what I am and made it a glory and not shame. But it is Kushiel who chose me for it. Let me serve as I was made to do, whether it be in your name or Nama's." After a moment Delaunay acceded with a curt nod.
"Then let it be. Only wait upon my word," he said, and returned to his letter.
Thus was the matter settled between us, and if I was at fault, it was only in failing to mark the significance when I saw that the courier who came for his letter bore the insignia of House Courcelle. When no reply was forthcoming, I put it out of my mind, and indeed Delaunay seemed reconciled. There was no funeral service, there was no family, and it would have been cruel, with Alcuin unable to attend, but he paid for full rites, and Guy was buried in the grounds of the sanctuary of Eloa, outside the city. In a week's time, Alcuin's wound had begun to knit, and bid fair to heal cleanly, although it would leave a fierce scar. I checked it daily, soaking off the bandage with warm water tinctured with valerian to dull the pain. If I had no skill at healing, at least I was trained to be deft, and he was grateful for it. Alcuin was a good patient. He never complained, which was no surprise, as it was not his nature to do so. On the seventh day, he even essayed a laugh to see me sniff at the wound, checking to see that it didn't mortify.
"Some physician you make," he said faintly,
pushing himself upright against the pillows and grimacing as the motion caught at his stitches. "Lie quiet," I retorted, dipping my fingers in the pot of salve and spreading it over his wound. The gash looked quite dreadful as it curved across his pale torso, but for all that it was healing. "If you want better tending, let Delaunay see it." Alcuin shook his head mutely, stubborn and unrelenting. I glanced at his face and sighed. Nothing could take away his unearthly beauty, but still he looked drawn and haggard. "Guy made his own choices, too," I told him, folding a fresh linen pad over his wound. "He knew the risks, better than either of us. He was the one hired to kill Delaunay, after all, and it was Delaunay who forgave him and took him in. You diminish his repayment of that debt if you take the blame all unto yourself." It was the first thing I had said that got through to him.
"It does not excuse my folly," he said stiffly.
"Ah, no," I said, winding the bandages back over the pad. "Others may err, but not Alcuin nor Delaunay." "Well, and if you think you are berating yourself for the failure, how much the more so do you guess Delaunay does, for failing to discern that you despised the service of Nama? I tell you, you should speak with him, Alcuin." I thought for a moment that he would soften, but his lips hardened, and he gave another brief shake of his head, withdrawing from conversation. Undismayed, I busied myself about his room, moving the washing bowl, folding bandages, corking the doctor's salve. "Now, which one of the Stregardza is Therese?" I asked, when I gauged that he was no longer paying attention to me. "Is she the firstborn?" "Prince Benedict's daughters are House Courcelle," I thought.
"They're of the blood by birth, like Lionette de Trevelyan, but Therese married a Stregardza cousin, Dominic."
I had caught his interest. His voice ran a little ahead of his thoughts. Alcuin had always been better than I at royal genealogies.
"A bad match, by all reckoning. He's a minor count. But then she was second-born. First is Marie-Celeste, who wed Vadoge's son. It's her son stands to inherit La Serenissima. Once Prince Roland died, I wager Dominic Stregardza thought to poise his family near the D'Angeline throne, though."
"And found his path blocked by House Lanvert," I mused. "How disappointed he must have been. But why would Delaunay care who killed Isabelle Lanvert? By all accounts she was his enemy." Alcuin shrugged, lifting up one hand and letting it fall.
"That I don't know."
"Perhaps it was her he loved, and not Edmé de Rocaille," I suggested. "Perhaps her betrayal lay not in causing the death of Prince Roland's first betrothed, but in becoming his second."
His eyes widened. "You can't think it, Phaedra. Delaunay would never condone murder. Never. And why would he honour the prince's promise concerning me, if it were true?"
Guilt? I suggested. He grew angry enough when I mentioned Roland's name the other day. Perhaps we have had it wrong all the while, and this feud between Delaunay and Isabelle Envers de la Courcelle was not enmity, but a love affair turned deadly bitter. Alcuin gnawed his lower lip, mulling over my words, while I concealed a smile. I had proposed it only to distract him, but it was too plausible to ignore.
"You're mad to think it," he repeated, visibly distraught,
colour risen in his pallid cheeks.
"It isn't in Delaunay to so dishonour himself, I know it."
"Well," I sat back and folded my arms, favouring him with a long glance, "you'll never know if you won't speak to him. And you've a better chance than I of getting the truth out of him by a far shot." We were trained by a master, both of us. It was only seconds before Alcuin realized what I had done and laughed. It was his true laugh, free and unfettered, the very one that had greeted me the first day I had arrived at Delaunay's house.
"Ah, no wonder they pay again and again for your charms."
I laid my price before Vital Bouvard like a farm wife in the market, while you coax secrets from their tongues and leave them none the wiser. Would that I'd half your gift for it. I would that you had too, I said ruefully, or found at least half the pleasure in it that I do.
Even half might kill me,
he smiled, quieting, and ran a fold of my gown through his fingers.
Your pleasures are too strong for my taste, Fedra.
Talk to him, I said, giving Alcuin a kiss and rising. Chapter 26. Healing of all kinds maintains its own pace, but there was no putting off the visit of Rogier Clavel, the lordling from Barkier Lanvers entourage. For one long day prior to our assignation, I thought Delaunay would cancel the contract, but at the last he came home with a mercenary in tow, a man with the unlikely name of Miquette, an Isandine Toria who had grown bull-shy after an incident which left a scar gouged into his left temple. My new guard had parlayed his skill with weapons into a lucrative sideline, and Delaunay gauged him reliable enough. He was slight and dark, with brows that drew together in a perpetual half-frown, and while I had no doubt of his skill with the blade, I was surprised to find how greatly I missed Guy's silent presence. We rode together in Delaunay's coach, and Miquette grated on my nerves with his restlessness. My assignation with Lord Clavel was at the palace itself. To my relief, my guard remained blessedly silent as we traversed its marbled halls, contenting himself with hovering behind me and scowling at everyone we passed. We were in one of the lesser wings, where minor dignitaries are housed, so we encountered no one I knew, although there were a few who saw my sangoir cloak and gave me secret looks, knowing who I was and what it betokened. Lord Rogier Clavel received me eagerly. He had the d'Angeline looks, but had been living a soft life in the court of the Caliph, and gone a little plump with it. Still, he had the haughty manners of a courtier, and dismissed Miquette quickly enough, for which I was grateful. Delaunay and I had gone over our strategy enough times, but still I needed no distractions.
"Fedra no Delaunay," Rogier Clavel said, putting on a formal voice that didn't quite disguise a quaver of eagerness. "I would appreciate it if you would put these items on."
He snapped his fingers for a servant who came bearing the flimsy gauze gowns of a harem girl. I bit my lip to keep from laughing. It was a scenario straight out of a standard night court text, the Pasha's fantasy. I had expected more from a man who'd been satisfied in the court of Kebel-Im Arkad. Still, I knew what was expected of me, and donned the transparent robes. Rogier disappeared, and I was ushered into a bedchamber, which was arrayed with genuine Arcadian appointments. It was more than nice, with luxuriant silk tapestries of elaborate abstract designs, and worked pillows fringed in gold. I sank down on these and knelt abeyant, waiting. The first of my lessons, and still among the most valuable. In time, Rogier Clavel entered, magnificent in his pasha's attire.
I kept from laughing at how his jowls quivered in his soft face beneath the splendid turban, kneeling to kiss the turned-up toes of his kidskin slippers. They guard their women well in Kebel-e-Markad, so I had heard, and so I came to understand, from the despite and desire mingled in him. Lord Clavel had been denied access, and he raged at it. Once I discerned this, we got on well enough. If he had been denied the harem, he had gold enough and had paid it for this afternoon's pleasure. There was no question of exotic tastes learned abroad. He bore a gilt-handled quirt, and it roused him to a fury to punish me with it, chasing me about the cushions and flailing at my buttocks, breathing hard to see the thin red welts that ensued. I turned to the languissement when he groaned, kneeling solicitously, unbuttoning his voluminous pantaloons and taking him into my mouth. I thought that would be the undoing of him, but he surprised me, spilling me onto my back and tossing my legs into the air, performing the act of giving homage to Nama with 2 years' pent vigor. It surprised him to bring me to climax, and made him solicitous afterward, which also might have made me laugh. "You paid for an anguisette, my lord," I murmured instead. "Are you unhappy to have gotten one?"
"No," he said, caressing my hair, eyes wide with startlement. "No, Ella was bald, no. I thought it was a myth, that's all."
"I am not a myth," I said, lying against him, and gazing up so he might better see the scarlet mote in my eye. "Are there no anguisettes in Kebel-e-Markad, then? 'Tis a cruel land, I am told."
"Kushiel's dart does not strike where Elowa and his companions have not laid their hand," Rogier Clavel said, tracing the curve of my breast through the thin gauze of my robes. "It is a harsh land indeed, and I am glad enough for a respite from it."
A shadow crossed his face.
"The bee is in the lavender," he quoted the exile's lament in a lovely, melancholy voice. "The honey fills the comb. I never understood the sorrow of it until I too was far from home."
It was easier than I had reckoned. I smiled and twisted away, sitting back on my heels to put up my hair. "Is it so, then, with all d'Angelines? Does even the Duke Lambert long for home?"
"Oh, my lord, the Duke," he said, watching me hungrily. "He is of Elowa's line, and would prosper anywhere, I think. The Caliph has given him lands and horses and men of his own, yet even he misses the soil of Terdange, it is true, and word has reached us of the fall of House Trevelyan. The Duke would return home once his daughter is wed, and relinquish his appointment. I have come to petition the King on his behalf."
My hand stilled on my hair, and I made myself resume, twining it into a loose coil and thrusting an Arcadian hairpin in place. "The Duke's daughter is to be wed?"
"To the Caliph's son." Rogier Clavel reached for me, plucking out the hairpin and filling both hands with my hair. Do that again, what you did before," he ordered, drawing my head down. "Make it last longer this time."
That I did, and well enough. He was no patron I would have chosen, for he had no true spark of Kushiel's fire in him, only a frustration so great he thought he burned with it. If I knew better, I would never say it aloud. Delaunay wanted this connection made, and anyway it never pays to be rude to a patron. Besides, I didn't mind. Having spent long years under Cecily Laveau-Perrin's tutelage, betimes it pleased me to be able to put that training to good use. I was born an anguisette, and can take no credit for that gift. But skills worthy of the finest adept of the first of the 13 houses I had acquired on my own merits, and I was justly proud of them.
"Ah, Verdra," Rogier Clavel groaned when it was done.
He lay sprawled on the cushions, his plump limbs slack with languor. He looked vulnerable and rather sweet, watching me with doting eyes as I rose to don my own gown.
"Phedra no Delaunay, you are the most splendid thing ever I have known."
I smiled without answering, and knelt gracefully to help him into a robe, covering him modestly.
"If,
Federer. If the Duke Lanvert's request is granted, and I am able to return with him, may I see you again?
Even after he had gained my consent, Delaunay had delayed some time before accepting Lord Clavel's offer for just this reason. I sat back and looked grave. My Lord Clavel, it is not for me to say. It is my Lord Delaunay's desire to cull my patrons from among the great houses. Was it one such who commended me to you?
It was.
His expression, tinged with worry by my words, changed. I had wondered if he would dare name Childeric Desarmes, but he didn't.
It was someone highly placed at court. Vedra, I have gold a plenty, and will surely be landed if we are allowed to return. The king will be grateful, for the duke has done much to advance d'Angeline relations with the caliph.
Yes, I thought, and succeeded in wedding his own daughter to the caliph's heir, which does much to advance Lanvert's relations with Kebble-e-Makkad. I did not say that, but murmured instead, "Indeed, and there is somewhat for which my Lord Delaunay would be grateful."
"What?" Rogier Clavel clutched eagerly at my hands. "If it is in my power, I will do it gladly."
"There is an old quarrel between my lord and the duke," I said, raising my eyes solemnly to meet his gaze. "I do not say it may be easily set aside, but my lord would take it kindly if it were made known to the duke that he is not averse to the idea of peace between their houses."
"Delaunay is not a noble house," Rogier Clavel said thoughtfully.
I saw a sharpness in him, and took note of the fact that, doting or no, he was not a fool.
"Anarfiel Delaunay. Never mind."
I bowed my head silently, and he reached out to raise my chin.
"Is your lord prepared to give his earnest word in this?"
"My Lord Delaunay guards his honour well," I answered truthfully. "He would not speak of peace if he intended ill." He debated with himself, gaze wandering over me, then nodded.
"I will make mention of it, if I am given occasion. You will see me again, then?"
"Yes, my lord." It cost me nothing to agree, and his answering grin was like dawn breaking. I watched him rise and go to a coffer atop a high table, belting his robe as he went. He opened the coffer and plunged his hands into it, filling them both with gold coins bearing an unfamiliar Arcadian stamp. While I remained kneeling, he returned, spilling a nobleman's ransom in gold over my lap.
"There," he exclaimed breathlessly, "if you should forget your promise, that should give you something to remember me by. I will light candles to Narmar in your honour, Fedra."
Gathering my skirts into a pouch to hold the gold, I rose and kissed his cheek. "You have done her a mighty homage 3 times already this day, my lord," I told him, laughing. "Surely your name rings in her ears." He blushed at it and called for the servants. It was but early in the night when I returned home. Delaunay thanked Miquette for a job well done. Little enough he had to do, although his scowl had kept everyone at bay, and dismissed him with pay. I was glad he was not to be taken on as a member of the household, though no doubt I'd be seeing him, or his like, soon enough again, if I was ever to have another contract. Perhaps Hyacinth would be able to find someone I would like better, I thought.
"Come out to the courtyard," Delaunay said. "It's warm enough with the brazier lit."
The courtyard was tolerably comfortable, and lovely as always by torchlight, the autumn foliage in bloom. To my surprise, Alcuin was there, carefully ensconced on a couch with a blanket tossed over his lower body to keep any touch of chill from his wound. He looked a shade less haggard and smiled briefly at meeting my eyes.
"Sit down."
Delaunay waved his hand at a couch and took another for himself, leaning forward to pour me a glass of cordial.
"Tell me," he said, handing me the glass, "how fares Barkier Lanvert?"
I sipped the cordial. "The Duke Lanvert is minded to relinquish his appointment and return to Terre d'Ange, my lord. He would leave in his stead one daughter, wed to the caliph's son." Delaunay's eyebrows rose.
"Kebble-e-Makkad, allied with House Lanvert?" The lioness of Arzal must be spinning in her grave. Well, no wonder Barkeel is ready to come home. He's gotten what he went for.
And the Caliph's heir will be kin by marriage to the Dangeline heir, Alcuin mused. Not a bad alliance for him.
My lord, I set down my glass and looked quizzically at Delaunay, is that why you wish to make peace with House Lanvert?
I knew naught of this until tonight, Delaunay said, shaking his head. No, it's not that.
He gazed at a torch, wearing the look he bore when he contemplated something neither of us could see. I glanced at Alcuin, who moved his head slightly in denial. He knew no more than I.
We have never been friends, Barkiel and I, but he stands to gain by the goals I seek. Time enough to put an end, or at least a truce, to the bad blood between us. Did it fall out as we planned? Was Lord Clavel agreeable to your suggestion?
He will speak to Lanvert of it, if he may, though he gave no promise. I picked up my cordial and took another sip, smiling. Still, I think memory of this day's pleasure will goad him to it. I made it clear enough where your interests lay, my lord, though for my part I am not averse to his gold.
And his company?
I shrugged. He is easy to please. I have passed duller afternoons, and had naught to show for it in the end. My mark will gain 2 inches from his patron gift alone.
Well, then, you may keep your word to him, if he should return. But once only, I think, unless he rises in the king's regard by this venture, to a title worthy of patronage. Still, I would that all your patrons were so harmless, Delaunay said ruefully, his gaze falling on Alcuin.
Any man may be dangerous when cornered, Alcuin murmured, or any woman. That is a lesson I have learned well, if late. My lord, what will you do now?
Now? Delaunay asked, surprised. Naught but to wait on word of the king's response to Lanvert's petition, and somewhat else. Then we will see.
Chapter 27. It was some days before we heard official word of the wedding of Valère Lanvert to Sinadin Jean Arbassin, heir to the caliphate in Kebel Imarkad. The king had chosen to give his blessing to the union, and the request of the Duc Lanvert was granted, although with one unspoken caution. If House Lanvert had hoped to maintain a monopoly in Kebel Imarkad, it was not to be. Barkier Lanvert's replacement as ambassador was one Comte Richard de Quille, who bore no love for the Lanvert clan. Interesting as these matters were, they took place very far away, in a country to which Dangeline ties were at best tenuous, and I failed to see what Delaunay's stake in the matter was. When word of Lanvert's impending return came, I thought he would reveal it, but he kept his silence. Whatever Delaunay waited on, he made it clear that I would have no assignations until it arrived, and worse, I was forbidden Knight's doorstep and Hyacinth's company. When I proposed that Hyacinth could find a suitable guard, Delaunay merely laughed. Condemned to idleness, I made do as best I could, tending to my studies. My old tumbling master would have been pleased to see I had not forgotten everything I had ever learned, and I practised diligently on the harp and lute and kithara, but being forced to it, these pleasures paled quickly. Alcuin mended more quickly these days, and the atmosphere in Delaunay's house had eased, for which I was grateful. I do not think they had fully resolved matters between them, for Guy's death was an open wound still, which we did not discuss, but the dreadful tension had broken. When Alcuin was well enough to travel, Delaunay brought him to the sanctuary of Nama, where I had gone betimes with Cecily Laveau-Perrin. What passed between Alcuin and the priests and priestesses of Nama, I do not know. He did not offer to tell me, and I did not ask. But he was 3 days in that place, and when he returned, I knew they had absolved him of any sin against Nama. A portion of the guilt that had clouded him was gone, and it shone freely in his every word and gesture. The healing waters of the springs had done him good, too. though he wouldn't allow Alcuin to venture into the city unattended any more than he did me. With the Yeshuite doctor's approval, Delaunay made Alcuin a gift of an elegant grey saddle horse. I was glad enough of Alcuin's recovery that I wasn't even jealous. Anyway, it is customary to present an adept with a gift when they have made their mark, and I am sure Delaunay was aware enough of the traditions of the Night Court to know it. To be precise, Alcuin's mark was not actually made. His still-healing wound prevented it, as it would be a lengthy business lying on his belly. But the necessary sum was in his coffer, and there was no question that his tenure was done. I made mention of it to Master Thielar when I put Rogier Clavel's patron gift to good use. Delaunay at least allowed me that much, though he ordered Hovel and another manservant to accompany me. They spent the time dicing in the wine shop, a freedom I envied. By this time I was suffering a tedium so deadly I would have gladly scrubbed the Marquise Belfort's chamber pot for the distraction of a scathing punishment at the end of it. In this state of mind I luxuriated under the Marquist's ministrations, lulled by the exquisite pleasure of the tight-needled tapper. Master Thielar shook his head and muttered under his breath, but I kept from twitching and gave him no cause for real complaint. Instead, I concentrated on the isolated pain, letting my mind still so that it became the center of my being. The session passed all too quickly, and I was surprised when Master Thielar gave my buttocks a light slap.
"You're done, child,"
he growled, and I had the sense he'd already told me once.
"Don your clothes and be on your way."
I sat up, blinking. The interior of the Marquis' shop was hazy beneath a veil of red. It cleared quickly, and I made out Master Thielar's apprentice coming toward me with averted eyes, blushing as he proffered my gown. He was nearly a man grown now, but no less shy than the first time I'd come. The new ink of my extended mark burned like fire, and I wondered what Master Thielar would say if I took his apprentice into the back room and relieved him of a measure of his shyness. "I'm sure you wouldn't betray Lord Delaunay's trust in such a way, would you, Phaedra?" With a sigh, I dressed, and hoped that Delaunay would allow me to return to the service of Narmar in short order. When I arrived at the house, my wine-cheered escorts in tow, I was met by one of the maidservants. "Lord Delaunay would see you in the library, Phaedra," she murmured, not quite meeting my eyes. Sometimes I missed my days at Sirius House, when I knew all the servants by name and called them friend. I'd felt it more than ever during this confinement, but I was heartened by the summons, thinking perhaps my hopes had been answered. Delaunay was waiting for me. He glanced up as I entered, shielding my eyes from the late afternoon sun that slanted through a window, bathing the many volumes on his shelves with a mellow glow. "You sent for me, my lord," I said politely.
"Yes,"
he smiled briefly, but his eyes were serious.
"Phaedra, before I speak further, I would ask you somewhat. You have some idea that there is a purpose in what I do, and if I have not revealed it to you, you know well enough that it is because I would afford you as much protection as ignorance allows. But I am reminded of late of how very slight that protection is. What you do is dangerous, my dear. You have said it once, but I ask you again, is it still your will to pursue this service?"
My heart leapt. He was offering another assignation. "My lord, you know it is," I said, making no effort to disguise my eagerness.
"Very well."
His gaze drifted past me, seeing again whatever it was Delaunay saw, then returned to my face.
"Know, then, that I am not minded to take the same risk twice. Henceforth your safety will be assured by a new companion. I have arranged that you will be warded by a member of the Castelline Brotherhood."
My mouth fell open. "My lord will have his jest," I said faintly.
"No."
A glimmer of amusement flickered in Delaunay's eye.
"It is no jest."
"My lord, you would set some dried-up old stick of a Castelline brother to trail after me?" Between outrage and astonishment, I nearly stammered it. "On an assignation? You would set a crotchety 60-year-old celibate toward a servant of Narmar? An Angi Set, no less. Name of Eloa, I'd rather you brought back Miket." For those who are unfamiliar with Dorjaline culture, I will explain that the Karsaline Brotherhood, like Eloa's companion Karsiel, are alone and united in their disapproval of the ways of Blessed Eloa. Like Karsiel, they serve with steadfast devotion, but I cannot imagine anything more off-putting to a patron of Narmar than their cold-eyed disdain. Aside from that, they are dreadfully unfashionable. Delaunay merely raised his eyebrows at my tirade. "Our lord and king, Garnelon de la Courcelle, is attended at all times by two members of the Karsaline Brotherhood. I would have thought you'd be honored by it." It is true that I had never, in the wildest of tales, heard tell of a Karsaline brother serving as companion to anyone not born to one of the great houses, let alone a courtesan. It would have given me pause had I not been so shocked. But I could not think beyond the grim effect the ascetic grey presence of a Karsaline brother would have on a hot-blooded patron. "Guy was trained by Karsaline brothers," I shot back at Delaunay. "And look what happened to him. What makes you think I would be any safer?" Delaunay's gaze strayed past me again. "If this man Guy was expelled at 14, an even voice said from behind me, "he had only begun the merest part of the training to become a Karsaline brother." Sparing a glare for Delaunay, I whirled about. The young man standing in the shadows behind me bowed in the traditional manner of the Karsaline Brotherhood, hands crossed before him at chest level. Warm sunlight gleamed on the steel of his vambraces and the chain mail that gauntleted the backs of his hands. His twin daggers hung low on his belt, and the cruciform hilt of his sword, always worn at the back, rose above his shoulders. He straightened and met my eyes. "Fedra no Delaunay," he said formally. "I am Jocelyn Verai of the Karsaline Brotherhood. It is my privilege to attend." He neither looked nor sounded as though he meant it. I saw the line of his jaw harden as he closed his mouth on the words. It was a beautiful mouth. Indeed, there was very little about Jocelyn Verai that was not beautiful. He had the old-fashioned noble features of a provincial lord, and the somber ash-grey garb of a Karsaline brother adorned a tall, well-proportioned form, like the statues of the old Hellene athletes. His eyes were a clear blue, the colour of a summer sky, and his hair, caught back in a club at the nape of his neck, was the colour of a wheat field at harvest time. At this moment his blue eyes considered me with scarce concealed dislike. "Jocelyn assures me that what happened to Alcuin and Guy would never occur to someone under his warding," Delaunay said in a calm tone. "I have measured my blade against his daggers, and I am satisfied that it is true." A Karsaline brother never draws his sword unless it is to kill. I had heard of it once, when an assassin attacked the king. I turned my head toward Delaunay, considering. "He bested you with daggers alone?" Delaunay made no answer, nodding toward Jocelyn, who gave his formal bow, arms crossed. He was not, I gauged, much older than I was. "In the name of Karsiel, I protect and serve," he said stiffly. Wholly unbidden, I took a seat, choosing one where I could see both of them. The back of the chair stung the new lines of my mark. If I agreed to this, Delaunay would allow me to return to the service of Narmar. If I did not, well, Delaunay had not offered a choice in the matter. I shrugged. "My lord, at least he is pretty enough to be an adept of serious house wearing fancy dress. If you will, then so be it. Is there an offer to entertain?" From the corner of my eye I could see Jocelyn Verai glare at being compared to an adept of the night court. Delaunay's mouth twitched, and I was sure he'd seen it too, but he answered seriously. "Offers are plenty, if you wish them, Fedra. But there is a matter I would have you attend first, if you would hear it." I inclined my head. "In the name of Kushiel, I..."
Enough.
Delaunay raised his hand, silencing me, but his glance took in Jocelyn Varay as well.
Fedra, you of all people should know better than to mock the service of Eloise's companions. Jocelyn, your prefect has gauged this matter worthy of your order's attendance, and you stand in danger of heresy if you question his judgment.
As my lord bids,
Jocelyn said with restraint, bowing. It would have grated on my nerves, this constant bowing, were his every motion not such a damnable pleasure to behold. What is it? I asked Delaunay. He gazed steadily at me.
The Duke Lanvert is due to return in a fortnight's time. I would have you request of Lord Childeric d'Essomme that he send word to Barquier Lanvert that I desire a meeting with him.
My lord, I raised my eyebrows, why d'Essomme? We have laid the groundwork with Rogier Clavel.
Because Barquiel will listen to him.
Delaunay shook his head.
Clavel is a minor functionary. Barquiel would dismiss him out of hand. He has served his use. Barquiel Lanvert has grown large with this new alliance, and I cannot afford to have him dismiss my request. D'Essomme got him the appointment in the first place. Barquiel will heed his words, and I need you to convince Childeric d'Essomme.
Then he will know, I said simply.
Yes.
Delaunay rested his chin on a fist. That's why I waited for the prefect's answer.
Do you think he will act against you?
I glanced sidelong at Jocelyn Varay, finding a sudden comfort in the quiet menace of his ashen castling attire, the daggers that